We know there are times where you're just too busy to sort through the mass of information that comes your way. So to make it easier for you to stay informed, subscribe to The Morning Agenda, WITF's news podcast, where the only agenda is you.
Funding for The Spark is provided by Capital Blue Cross, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Cross Connect Health and Wellness Centers, which provide in-person services and inspire healthy living. Learn more at capitalbluecross.com. The Spark is also supported by UPMC. Choose UPMC for your family's health care needs close to home. Visit upmc.com/centralPA for a complete list of services and locations.
The glass ceiling, a metaphor for a barrier that kept women and other marginalized people from advancing, usually in their careers. The term is and was used often when a woman had reached a position or place in society for the first time. Breaking through the glass ceiling was seen as how far we've come as a society. But that glass ceiling isn't the final destination or even the ultimate barrier for many women. What about the glass walls? Wilson College's Chief Information Officer Amy Deal has identified obstacles that women in the workplace still face in a book she co-wrote called Glass Walls, Shattering the Six Gender Bias Barriers Still Holding Women Back at Work. Dr. Deal will appear with Dickinson College's Chief Information Officer Jill Forrester a week from today at Dickinson's Anita Tuven Schlechter Auditorium to discuss gender bias. And both Dr. Deal and Jill Forrester are with us on The Spark today. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Dr. Deal, let me start with you. A question
You can call me Amy.
No, your book said, Doctor, that women should get the titles they've earned.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, we can go into what happens when women when people right. don't use women's titles. It's a very common form of gender bias. So I appreciate you using mine.
Well, that's why I made a point of doing that. So how about I switch back and forth between Amy and Dr. Deal? Okay. Well, then, Amy, let me start with that. A question I often ask the author of a book is what the inspiration was for the book. But you actually write about the genesis of this book. Tell us the story. You're muted.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yep. Then we can hear you. Okay.
Yeah, sorry, my other microphone cut out. Apologies. Go ahead. What was that again?
The genesis of the book.
Oh, yes. Okay. So 10 years ago, I met my co-author, Dr. Leanne Dubinsky, at a conference, and it was out in Utah. And we had both come off of finishing our PhDs. I had done mine in, I had interviewed 26 women in higher education about challenges that they had experienced. And Leanne had Dr. Dubinsky had interviewed 12 faith-based nonprofit leaders. We sat down and we started talking, and we quickly realized that the women's experiences were very, very similar. And we were very surprised because my participants, they were from higher education, which is thought of as being liberal, progressive. Whereas she was studying religion, which is, you know, thought of to be more conservative. But we realized quickly that women were experiencing challenges in leadership because they were women, and not because of the particular organization or sector or anything like that. There's this commonality that we all experience in the workforce of workplace gender bias. And so that was the genesis of us putting our research together. And it was the genesis of us wanting to really understand the concept of gender bias comprehensively. There have been research done, articles written where, you know, somebody maybe studied this facet of it or that facet. We decided we wanted to understand it completely and fully. And so what we did was we partnered with two other researchers who were quantitative researchers. Leanne and I are qualitative researchers. We built a scale. We built a scale to measure gender bias. Out of that scale development, we were able to identify the six primary core barriers or glass walls that make up gender bias. And so I always say that, you know, we didn't just pull these six out of the air. We didn't just write about our six favorite ones. These were developed and surfaced in a very scientific way. So once we finished the scale development, we then, Dr. Dubinsky and I did further research that became the focus of this book, which was to take the six barrier, then and really thoroughly explain them, as well as provide solutions. We felt it really important to provide solutions for leaders in organizations, for allies, and for the women themselves. And so that's the synopsis of the book in a quick nutshell.
Well, there are multiple solutions, and we'll talk about that a little later in the program, as well as the six bias glass walls. But Joe Forrester, before we get into that, I mentioned glass ceilings. One almost gets the sense that we as a society were proud of ourselves. We were patting ourselves on the back when we heard about a woman breaking a glass ceiling to show that, see, there's no longer bias toward women in the workplace. Was that kind of a, I don't know, to make ourselves feel good or something?
I think so. I think as a society, we have come a long way from where we were perhaps back in the 1950s. However, I've read Amy's book, and one of the things that I really enjoyed about reading it is her and Leanne actually provide names for these biases. And so they give you a way to actually identify them. So we may think, yes, we've come a long way. Look, we even have a woman who's a vice president right now. But these biases still exist in the workplace. And some of them are just because of societal norms that are established. And a great example of one is, you know, well, we have moved from where we were in the 1950s to where we are now in the 2020s, we still have very traditional roles in terms of a family unit, right? Where you might have two parents, but one will be the primary caregiver and the other perhaps a primary supporter, one in the workforce. And more often than not, you see the caregiver role being given to the woman. And that can really prohibit a woman from progressing in her career up into a leadership role. And so I think one of the things that Amy and her co-author did in this book is identify these biases so that women can put a name to them and say, yes, I actually am being constrained because of these biases. And here are some solutions for moving me forward. So self solutions as a woman, but also how can my allies help me progress my career? How can leadership help me progress my career? So I do think we have certainly come a long way, but we haven't arrived, I will say that. And I think anytime we can look critically at how our organizations are supporting women, that is a good thing for the organization as a whole.
So, Amy, I can just hear dozens of our listeners, maybe hundreds, saying, Scott, stop burying the lead. What are the six glass walls?
And I'm glad you asked.
I'll go through them quickly.
The first one is male privilege. Male privilege is men's inherent advantage caused by workplace cultures in which men are the leaders. They control the resources, they set the standards, and they assign women to a second-class status. So women are allowed into the organization in ways that support the men's privilege. The second one is disproportionate constraints. So again, women are allowed into the workplace, but they are constrained to act in ways that are supportive of the men and held to unequal standards when compared to the men. And examples of disproportionate constraints include things like muting women's voices, and giving them increased more scrutiny, putting them under more scrutiny than what men experience. The third one is insufficient support, where women lack access to social structures and networks that would help them to advance. And it actually includes unsupportive leadership in which leaders ignore women's needs or concerns. Fourth one is devaluation. It's attempts to make women seem unimportant and detract from their authority. One example is something that we didn't coin this term, but it's a term that's out there. It's called office housework. It's when women are assigned all the tasks that aren't what are typically thought of as promotable tasks. So it's like cleaning the office refrigerator, taking notes in a meeting, even just helping a colleague with a project. It's, you know, it's all those things that it's like, well, you're the woman, you're expected to do it. And if you just say no to that, you're going to get backlash. Another type of devaluation is very common, which we all know about, is how women are paid less than men for the same work, which is illegal in the United States, but unfortunately it happens all the time. Fifth one out of the six is hostility. Hostility is an active resistance to women's presence in the workplace through overt discrimination, harassment, and retaliation. The goal of hostility is to keep women in their supposed place. And I want to make a note here because I always get asked this question. Sometimes it's the women who are worse to me than the men. It's this hostility barrier also does include female hostility. And it's female hostility occurs because the women have been, again, we're all socialized into the same system, and the women have been experiencing discrimination. And so they may be given the very real perception that if they lose their perch, if they lose their spot, another woman has to, like, if another woman comes up, they're going to lose their spot, that they have to do everything they can to maintain their hard-earned spot. So the female hostility comes about due to the insecurity that the women are made to feel in the workplace. And then last, as a result of all the other barriers, last one is acquiescence. Women internalize the obstacles, accept them as valid, and adapt to the limitations. One example is being silent on issues, self-silencing, keeping quiet on workplace sexism, or even their own experiences of harassment. And that's for self, as a self-protection mechanism. And then women may also limit their own aspirations. When, you know, self-limited aspirations, that sounds like, well, that's just a choice. The woman made that choice to not go for that top job or not go for that position. Well, there's two things that cause the self-limited aspirations. One is when women are made to feel that they just can't do the job. Like they've experienced all this, you know, all these barriers. Every message is telling them that they aren't prepared. They can't do it. The other type of self-limiting aspirations is when women feel that they can do it, but they just don't want the hassle. Like they know that as they move up in the hierarchy, they're going to experience more sexism, more bias, more discrimination. And they just don't want the hassle that they're going to have to endure, that they see that their male peers won't have to. And so they just determine that, hey, I'm okay where I'm at. I'm not where I want to be, but it's for my mental and emotional health. This is where I'm going to stay. Very, very rational choice.
So, Amy, you went over the six glass walls. In the book, you offer multiple solutions. I mean, just an extensive mm-hmm. list of solutions. We probably would spend the entire time on the air listing them all, but what are some of the most significant ones?
Well, in the book, we really put the onus on leaders in an organization to overcome this problem. It does take all of us working together, but leaders really set the standards for their culture and for their organization. And so what we say, one of the first things that leaders should do is really diagnose the problem. We offer a tool. I mentioned earlier the scale that we developed, the gender bias scale for women leaders, that can be given to women in an organization to assess exactly which barriers are impacting the women in the organization, and which also helps to prioritize interventions. But there's lots of other ways that leaders can help create an inclusive environment. And I'll give you a couple examples. One is to create an environment where your internal environment relies on cooperation instead of competition. Another way is to make sure that your environment does not glamorize overwork. To make sure that all of your employees are working reasonable schedules. And, you know, Jill was mentioning this, but what we find is that when we've got, you know, certainly in heterosexual partnerships, if a man has the, you know, very demanding job, he's got a wife that's staying home, perhaps taking care of the kids, he can work 24/7. Well, that's not the reality for most families across the United States. So we really put the onus on leaders to create an environment where, you know, people work their full workday and then they're not expected to be on call, you know, or having to attend to, you know, non-emergencies after hours and on the weekends. Another thing that leaders can do too is make sure that decisions are being made within the confines of your workplace, within the confines of meetings that include all the stakeholders. And the reason I bring this one up is because so often we find that, too often we find that decisions are being made in places like out on the golf course, on or in the bar after work where the men are congregating to, you know, socialize or, you know, have some downtime, but they're also talking about work. And so there's a solution here for allies, too. And that is, if you're in the middle of a conversation, you're at the bar, you're on the golf course, and it turns to work, you can say, hey, let's table this and let's talk about it Monday when we can include Amy and Jill and make sure that they're involved in the conversation, right? So, like, I'm not trying to stop anybody socializing or having a good time, but it does. But those places don't need to be places where we're making decisions that impact everybody in the workplace without those individuals being present.
Well, Amy, I have to say that your list goes the whole nine yards. And you know why I said that.
Yes, they do.
one of the things you point out in the book is that men often use sports metaphors for reaching goals or in their everyday speech, mm-hmm. and that not everyone is familiar with those metaphors.
Yeah. And like, they become so common, I think, too, that some, like, even I wasn't even sure that I wouldn't have picked up on what you were saying because I'm so used to hearing them, right? That you were, yes, you're absolutely giving a sports metaphor. Another one is like a Hail Mary, right?
Yeah.
Let's just take this Hail Mary. Well, if you're a woman who's maybe not, you know, if you're someone who's not, you know, a big sports fan, or if you're somebody who's like an international person, you know, somebody who's not a native born in America, they may not know what those terms mean. So it's better just to not use them. Like, if you're, instead of saying Hail Mary, you can say, hey, let's make a last effort at this, our last best effort. You know, you can change the language so that you're not constantly referring to things with sports terms that not everybody may get.
Yeah. Jill, you touched on this earlier when you were talking about how women are making up the most of, you know, what's happening at home, caregiving, children, cooking, cleaning, things like that. What about the pandemic? Because the COVID-19 pandemic, I think, opened a lot of people's eyes when it came to, who's going to watch the kids? Daycare centers, childcare, you know, so much of life was impacted. Jill, what about that? What impact did it maybe had some positive and negatives as far as opening people's eyes, but what impact did that pandemic have?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. And Amy actually does touch on this in the book. And there have been quite a number of studies about the impact specifically to women during the pandemic, because as we know, what happened, schools shut down. It wasn't just that workplaces shut down and then we needed to work from home. It was schools shut down. And depending on the age of children in your family, that school shutting down could have meant that you were then responsible for really educating your children at home. And if you were in the workforce, I think it became a choice in families who then was going to basically put their career on hold for a period of time so that they could support their children. A very noble thing to do, certainly. But more often than not, and many of these studies point to this, including the evidence in Amy's book, that it was women who put their careers on hold and in many cases actually stopped out of the workforce altogether. It wasn't that, well, I need to work part time or, you know, I'll work after hours. They actually had to stop out of the workforce. And when that happens to a woman who's on a professional trajectory towards leadership, it's not just if they step out of the workforce for a year that they've been set back a year. It really is a setback of could be 5 to 10 years on their professional trajectory to once again get the leadership opportunities that perhaps they were aspiring to. So very definitely a very real impact to women during the pandemic.
And I would assume that we're talking about not just women on a path to management or to leadership, but women in almost any occupation. I mean, there are some obstacles that women have faced over the years anyway, but the pandemic really put a spotlight on them for sure. So we only have about a minute left, and there are so many other things we could talk about. But Amy, what do you want readers to take away from your book?
Two things. First one is that this is a completely solvable problem. It's a very hard problem, but it's completely solvable. And so in the book, like I said, we give lots of strategies, lots of solutions, no matter where you are and who you are on any given day, you can take advantage of these solutions to make positive change. The second one is a message for women. And that is if and when gender bias happens to you, do not take it personally. It happens to all of us. It's something systemic. It's in our society. You've got people like myself, my co-author, and many, many others of us who are working to root it out. But just understand, it's not a personal failing on your part.
How can you not take it personally, though? And I asked that question with about 30 seconds to go.
It's hard, but one of the ways I stopped taking it personally was I started studying it, right? And so that's why learn as much as you can about it, because once you can recognize it, you can realize that there are patterns here, and these things are happening to all women. It does make it easier. When you realize it's not you, it's not about you, and it's not unique to you.
The book is Glass Walls Shattering the Six Gender Bias Barriers Still Holding Women Back at Work. One of the co-authors is Dr. Amy Deal. She'll be speaking with Jill Forrester, Dickinson College, next Monday night. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.